Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'll tell you this, our model will always be inclusive. Whatever model we decide that we want to create or build in our communities will include everyone. Folks will be allowed to walk into any of our stores and shop. Whether you are a member, whether you are visiting for the first time, there will be no restrictions to the folks that can participate in the access of food. So we want people to be included. We want them to come as they are and meet them in the areas in which they want to be involved. We are a nonprofit. We're going to operate our grocery stores first and foremost as a nonprofit because we want to make sure that we build and amplify everything that we're doing in our communities and we support our communities. But the way that our community interacts with our store, we will build that together on the level that is needed for the people that will participate.
You just heard Kelvin Tate talking about the ethos of East Brooklyn Mutual Aid, an organization that has distributed food to over 100,000 Brooklyn residents since the start of the pandemic. We'll hear more from Kelvin later in the episode. Today, we're leaving the supermarket behind and unpacking the possibilities of alternative foodways, including cooperatives, mutual aid, CSAs, and the Black Panther Free Breakfast Program. For this episode, I'm thrilled to welcome HRN intern Liv Cunnins-Berkowitz as my co-host. Their research focuses on alternative and community-constructed foodways. Hey, Liv, welcome.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to dive into this together. So without further ado, I'm Matt Patterson.
And I'm Liv Cunnins-Berkowitz.
And this is Meat and Three on HRN.
Meat and Three.
Meat and Three.
Meat and Three.
One meat. Three sides.
Food, news, and storytelling.
A square meal. For your ears.
Meat and Three.
So, Liv, today we're talking all about alternative models of buying and distributing food. So I'm wondering, where do you go to buy your food?
Well, I've lived in a bunch of different places over the last couple of years, so that's changed. When I lived in Maine, I definitely went to Hannaford's a lot. That's the big grocery store up there, but also always try to go to the farmer's market because I like having connections with the people making my food. And then smaller stores like cooperatives or neighborhood grocery stores and lots of farmer's markets because those are abundant here in California. Where do you get your food, Matt?
I mean, sort of a similar situation in that I've lived a bunch of places. My happiest food buying situations were in San Diego and in New York. I was a part of co-ops that had slightly different models, but they had both been around for a really long time. And they were really, really wonderful places to shop. I have very, very recently moved to Providence, Rhode Island, and I'm still just scratching the surface of what is available here, but I've been to a farmer's market and am looking forward to finding out what else is out there. For most Americans, though, the answer to where do you buy your groceries is not a local co-op or even the farmer's market, I don't think. It's probably the supermarket, yeah?
Yeah, and I feel like when I've lived in more rural places, the supermarkets are huge and you're kind of walking up and down these aisles and there's these really brightly colored packages and cartoon characters on the packaging, and everything is super bright with fluorescent lights, and it's definitely a really different experience than, you know, going to the farmer's market. What I love about the supermarket is you can kind of get everything, but at the same time, sometimes it feels weird to have like cabbages and ice cream cones and dog food like all together, and that's not how it used to be. I don't know if you know, but there existed an era before the grocery store. It's kind of only about 100 years old. It came out in the 1900s. And Before that, people had their baker where they would go for bread and the butcher for meat. And you kind of interacted with this purveyor who was between you and the products. And now it's just us free range in the grocery store with our shopping carts and millions of items.
Yeah. And I remember you mentioned a fun fact about like the abundance sort of being used as like a symbol of American supremacy.
Yeah. So this is really interesting. I feel like when people think of the Cold War, they think about nuclear and the kind of huge ideological battles between the Soviet Union and America. But food was actually a big part of America trying to show that the capitalist model was better. So this was during this period of industrialization of agriculture. America was producing more food than it ever had. And the grocery store was kind of this way for Americans to display their abundance, to say, look how good this economic system works. And it's actually so much so that in 1957, at the World's Fair in Yugoslavia, the U.S. exhibited a fully stocked supermarket. And so they brought all these American products, set up a supermarket so that people living under communism could, you know, witness what they believe were the virtues of the free market. And that was the first time there was ever a supermarket in the Soviet Union.
I feel like you wouldn't believe it. That was a real thing.
Totally. I mean, I grew up not even being able to imagine an alternative to the grocery store. They're not obvious. And there's a lot of people throughout history who have been committed to imagining alternatives. First, there was just the alternatives before the grocery store. But then once the grocery store became really popular in America, and that was kind of during the 1950s, it was during suburbanization, the rise of post-war prosperity, people had a lot more money to spend, especially white Americans. And major grocery chains like A&P kind of took advantage of this moment and constructed massive supermarkets all across the suburbs. And they looked abundant, but they didn't really meet a lot of people's needs. First of all, a lot of supermarkets don't actually have all the products. There's kind of this illusion of choice. You can have like 20 different types of cereals, but maybe not certain cuts of meat that might be culturally relevant to you. And then the last thing is just alienation. I don't know if you've ever felt this, but kind of to me, when I'm in the grocery store, it almost feels like the products sprouted up on the shelves, like they're not actually from anywhere, like a factory or let alone a farm. Mm. There's all these quotes I found through looking at poetry and looking at Natural Living magazines in the 1960s, people kind of criticizing the supermarket as this epitome of alienation, where they're separated from the land and they're separated from farmers and the people who produce their food. And the food kind of becomes only a commodity and not part of a cycle that nourishes themselves.
Right. So today we're focusing on all these people that are reimagining alternatives, right?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about cooperatives and mutual aid, CSAs, which are community-supported agriculture. And I also wanted to talk about the Black Panther free breakfast program, which was around in the 1960s. And that was this really revolutionary model of getting food to people in need. One thing that's really important to note is that alternative food ways have been really essential in Black communities because the American food system has really failed to meet their needs. So major supermarkets often move into predominantly white suburban communities and have ignored Black communities. This phenomenon is often called supermarket redlining. And because the giant supermarkets have historically neglected predominantly Black communities, the communities have had to take it upon themselves to organize alternatives.
So yeah, for our first story, producer Elias Guerra introduces us to one professor who has devoted decades to researching the role of African Americans in cooperative economics.
Most people are not aware of the long history of cooperatives in America, and even more so, people don't know the essential role that Black co-ops have played in laying the foundation. Jessica Gordon Nemhard is the author of Collective Courage, A History of African American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. As she describes it, before she wrote the book, there was little to no research on the role of African Americans in cooperative economics. She's a professor of community justice and social economic development at John Jay College, and an inductee into the U.S. Cooperative Hall of Fame. Jessica says the history of Black cooperative economics goes way back, often started informally and out of necessity.
Early mutual aid societies really started with burial, right? As an enslaved person or even a newly freed person without much resources, you were just going to get not buried properly. But as African people, we had a sense of how important it was to bury the dead.
People pitched in so that friends and family could be laid to rest in a dignified manner. Other early co-ops included agriculture co-ops to buy and share tools, and food co-ops to share resources. Jessica says when she first started talking to Black folks about cooperatives, their reaction was not always enthusiastic. Many people associated cooperatives with white hipsters and didn't know about the role of Black people in co-ops. As she explained the different shapes that co-ops can take, her audience would recall a food co-op a parent did, or a giveaway at a church when they were a child. But this initial misunderstanding was not by accident.
We had a lot of Black leaders talking about using co-ops for actual liberation and to get us out of slavery, out of segregation. But the minute we started talking like that, we became targets of people, especially white supremacists, who didn't want us to succeed. So one of the reasons it was so hard for me to dig it up was because, one, we had to do a lot of it underground.
Jessica says that many times Black folks would use some other terminology besides cooperative. When fears of communism and Black power were popular, it was important to avoid certain words that might spark a backlash. Black-owned co-ops were a threat to white power and could be more successful than their white counterparts.
There's a great example in Richmond. They actually started a food co-op across the street from an A&P because the A&P refused to hire a Black person and wasn't friendly to them. And they were like, okay, in your face, we're going to start our own grocery store. It's going to be a co-op and we're going to be right across the street from you.
Soon the Richmond co-op had more employees, more volume, and more business. And within 2 years, the A&P almost went out of business. This was not always the case, but as Jessica puts it, it was a matter of access and self-determination.
You know, one, we need the food and the access, but also there was that political social aspect. We're not going to let people disrespect us.
Cooperatives surged during periods of Black power movements and labor movements.
So the 1880s, the U.S. was abandoning Reconstruction and starting Jim Crow. The KKK was starting, but there was a strong Black movement to resist to resist the backlash.
Cooperatives gave people the power to pool their resources and fight back by taking care of one another. Co-ops surged during the Great Depression and again during the Civil Rights era.
And in the 60s and 70s, we did have the explosion of Black power, civil rights movements, and needing to couple economic justice with racial justice became very apparent again. So it is survival, but it's not just survival.
Although many Black cooperatives have disbanded over the years, Jessica doesn't see that as a failure. They move in ebbs and flows. And she says the benefits we gain can continue even after the organization is gone.
There was also a great study of that co-op in Virginia in 1901. That co-op lasted, I think it was 20 years. They started like two or three other minor small co-ops and a school.
Even once the co-op disappeared decades later, the community still had a sense of collective responsibility. Jessica thinks that cooperatives give us space to practice and improve our social dynamics, something sorely needed in these stressful times.
Not magical, but participating in a co-op means that you can't be isolated, right? You're working with other people, you're making decisions with other people.
Even in a dog-eat-dog world, cooperation nurtures the part of ourselves that capitalism cannot touch.
There's so much learning, not just about how to run the business, not just about the industry you're in, but there's this learning about how to be a human being again. There's an understanding that things are supposed to be transparent.
Jessica says that cooperatives teach a different kind of ethics, not just top-down, but one where everyone can understand the budget and expenses, and everyone gets a say.
Even if we have to go back to an unsatisfactory job where we're just a cog, at least at home in our community, you know, we're going to do some other stuff because we've been changed by that relationship.
At a time when division is the most common threat in our lives, what cooperatives teach us is more important than ever. We all depend on each other for survival and for our happiness. Jessica is the author of Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice.
So as Jessica explained, from the early 1900s all the way through the 1970s, co-op organizers were consistently accused of being communist and anti-American just for trying to operate a grocery store that catered to their community's needs. And the truth is, among people who've engaged in cooperatives, some weren't at all looking to overthrow the capitalist system or even really imagine an alternative. They were just trying to get food to their people and their community. But there are also people, especially in the 1960s, who thought that the grocery store, especially the cooperative grocery store, could be an outpost of the political revolution. And I can kind of break it down to you this way, Matt. political organizers always have to struggle with trying to get people to care about what they're talking about. How do you kind of get people in the door? And a lot of activists in the 60s thought that the storefront was the perfect model because people come in to get their beans or their rice or chicken or whatever you need. And you could have a little political conversation at the checkout line and they come back. And slowly that's a way to radicalize people or get them to join your movement.
Sure. This is like politicians targeting bars and bar patrons on voting day or something. It's like meet the people where they're at.
Exactly. And the people got to eat. We all need food. And so meeting people while they're eating is the perfect way to kind of begin those political conversations.
Sure.
And in my opinion, no one really did this better than the Black Panthers. So I'm taking us back to the 1970s. And this was the time when America was the richest country in the world and had one of the largest populations of hungry children, which, I mean, is just clearly a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Black Panthers took it upon themselves to nourish poor Black kids, partly because they cared about their community and they just wanted to feed people. But I also think they knew that it would expose the American government for not meeting the need of so many people. In the early 1970s, the Panthers established a free breakfast program, and it spread to 45 cities across America. And they were consistently feeding upwards of 50,000 children, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, wow.
And for the Panthers, food was inherently political. And I just have to kind of give you this quote from Panther Party Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton. He described the Black Panther service program as follows, quote, "First you have free breakfasts, then you have free medical care, then you have free bus rides, and soon you have freedom," unquote. So he kind of thought that this food was just kind of this one step towards this greater promise of freedom, because he believed in a free world, everyone is fed, and the American government, which preached freedom, was not able to pull that off. So the Panthers really exposed the fact that the U.S., the richest country in the world, also had one of the largest populations of hungry children. And this was threatening, really deeply threatening. So the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, wrote, quote, "BCP, which is the Breakfast for Children program, represents the best and most influential activity going on for the Black Panther Party, and as such is potentially the greatest threat to efforts by the authorities to neutralize the Black Panther Party and destroy what it stands for," unquote.
That's pretty intense for somebody just trying to feed some kids.
Exactly. So the Panthers were nourishing their community, and it was just a huge threat to the American government at the time because this small, or not small, but this more ragtag organization was able to provide services that the American government either was unwilling to or infrastructurally unable to. And the thing is, the free breakfast program was so successful and it inspired the U.S. government to begin a permanent school breakfast program in 1975 that persists to this day. Because they knew if the Panthers were feeding people better than the government, people would turn to the Panthers and kind of take away support for the government.
That's an incredible, incredible legacy.
It's an incredible legacy. We really do have to thank the Panthers for this inspiration. And it shows that, you know, the co-op, which oftentimes is just a space to get food, really has been historically a site of a real threat to the American model. And that's in part because this grocery store is so entrenched in the image of American capitalism.
Well, yeah, it's like deeply ironic that we would be trying to portray a certain image via the grocery store abroad, but in reality have such hunger at home that, you know, the Panthers felt they needed to institute this program.
So the truth is, kind of all throughout American history, when the government has failed to meet the needs of its most vulnerable citizens, community members have stepped up and organized to support each other, to cook for each other, to feed each other. So we're going to travel from the 1970s to the present day to talk about how this played out during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right. So here's Charlotte Rhodes visiting HRN's neighbors at East Brooklyn Mutual Aid.
East Brooklyn Mutual Aid describes their work as being about living in solidarity with one another, about exchanging resources to best support the community at large. People give what they can and take what they need, all without the expectation of receiving something in return. East Brooklyn Mutual Aid, or EBMA, was formed during the pandemic to meet urgent needs of the community after their co-founder, Calvin Tate, recovered from COVID himself. Federal, state, and local responses to the pandemic revealed deeply rooted systemic issues that the EBMA came together in response to. Kelvin describes how East Brooklyn was situated in such a way that the dangers of the pandemic fell unevenly onto the neighborhood.
Discrimination, redlining, racism. I mean, we are put in certain areas of our communities with the least amount of resources where other communities have everything that they need at prices that they can afford, and we have things that we can't afford. You know, we don't have enough hospitals for the folks that live here. We don't have enough transportation for the folks that live here. We don't have enough grocery stores for the folks that live here. So, of course, we were going to get the shorter end of the stick when everything fell apart and the city didn't have a plan. We had to fend for ourselves. And how much of that can we do when we physically don't have the resources?
EBMA began with delivering groceries directly to 30 households. Their Black Radish program, which sources groceries from predominantly Black farmers, has now distributed more than 1 million pounds of food to over 100,000 residents throughout Brooklyn's eastern neighborhoods. EBMA undertakes education and political action as it relates to food, which sets it apart from other alternative models of grocery.
Absolutely. Food justice is important for our seniors, for our young people, for everyone. You know, we want people to understand how to consume food, how to grow food, and how to maintain the community around them and the people around them through food. You know, understanding the food chain, number one, understanding where your food comes from, understanding some basic needs of agriculture, basic needs of how to grow and harvest your own food, basic culinary needs of how to support yourself, you know, basic culinary education, knife skills, nutritional education. Food is medicine, you know, and if we start to think of food as medicine and that everyone has a basic human right to food, then our communities would be healthier. Our communities would have less mental issues, less social issues, spiritual issues. All of those things, in my opinion, surround food.
The mutual aid model prioritizes the most food insecure: elderly people, disabled folks, youth, and low-income families. Autonomy underpins EBMA's fight for food justice, whether it is through providing educational tools or supporting local Black and brown farmers.
You know, less than 1% of farmers in New York State are Black or brown, and they get very minimal support. So if we as a community don't support them, then how else are they going to be supported? I think that it starts with us first. You know, we support our own. Every other community supports from within. You know, we do the same thing, and we do a really good job at it when we come together.
Kelvin says autonomy is also about bringing the choice back to the community, to be in control of what to eat, where it comes from, and how much it costs.
It is soul work. The work that we do in our communities is passion-driven, and it really is soul food. You know, that's really what it is. And you have to kind of have that same spirit in you and really believe in the work that you're doing and love the work and the people that you're doing it for, and yourself, because you're a part of that community, you know? So it's soul food, really.
Mutual aid is so much more than providing people with groceries. It is the commitment to meet community needs in tangible and intangible ways. Just like soul food, it fills both the body and the heart.
EMBA is bringing products straight from farmers to consumers. It's a big deal because at the supermarket, only 15 cents of every dollar you spend on an item is actually going to the farmer. The rest goes to processing, marketing, shipping, and executives. We're in this moment where Americans are imagining new ways to shop from small farmers rather than further feeding agribusiness. And another one of these models are CSAs, or community-supported agriculture. For farmers, CSAs ensure a reliable source of income because customers are committing to paying even before the first seeds are planted in the ground. And community members get to enjoy delicious and locally produced food. And the thing is, farmers take on a lot of risk when they're working, and CSAs are a great way for customers to help take on that risk with them. It's also a great way to try new vegetables. A lot of farmers don't promote plant and crop biodiversity because certain types of vegetables aren't necessarily profitable. But if you sign up for a CSA, farmers might slip in new crops, and it's been a way for me that I've learned to cook all types of vegetables that I wasn't previously familiar with.
Yeah, I think anybody who's like done a CSA has had that experience of receiving a thing and then being like, what do I do with this? But that's great because it broadens your horizons.
Yeah, so CSAs, their history is actually slightly ambiguous, but they seem to really emerge in the U.S. in their current form during the mid-1980s. And today, more than 1,700 farms across the country run CSA programs.
So for our last story, Sasha DeBose explores how one CSA is working to make farm fresh produce accessible for everybody, at least everybody in their community.
This summer, I'm thinking about the best ways to get my favorite produce. Big grocery stores don't cut it for me all the time. I'll sift through the produce to find something fresh, but even my best selection leaves something to be desired. But farmers markets and CSAs can be inaccessible for a variety of reasons, from only being open when most folks are at work, to out-of-the-way pickup locations, what's a tomato lover supposed to do? Francis Yu is working to address that lack of accessibility. They are the deputy director of the Catskills Agrarian Alliance, which houses the 607 CSA, a multi-farm CSA based in the northern Catskills of New York.
And so our members have access to over 40 regional, small to mid-scale family farms up here who are doing such beautiful work. I think that that was sort of like the original premise of why bring together all of these different farms is just to like kind of like streamline some of that work and make sort of the handling the logistics and the transportation of that much more easier, again, for producers, and then expanding the offerings that we can provide to consumers.
The 607 CSA has about 350 members spread out between New York City and the Catskills. Connecting people to the bounty grown in their local food shed is really important to Francis.
Why is it cheaper for a grocery store to source, you know, food from thousands of miles away versus like within the region or within the state even? The USDA and various sort of like free trade deals and agreements like make certain products much more accessible because of the enormous amount of subsidies or otherwise like financial tools that like the large scale industrial agro businesses are able to access.
These subsidies not only impact small farmers, but they dictate the produce we have access to in supermarkets. Finding solutions to current barriers is key to keeping people fed. 607 offers a tiered pricing system that provides discounts to those who can't afford a full share. Solidarity shares, which are offered at no cost to low-income families, encourage collaboration between members and farmers.
It's all opened up different sort of like collaborations and partnerships for folks who like would love access to the CSA, but like don't have like the financial means.
CSAs are more than monthly veggie baskets. 607's programs, like their door-to-door delivery service for lower-income communities in the Catskills, center marginalized folks who do not have access to fresh produce.
To me, I really love the way that food is like a medium to all of these other sort of political dimensions, right? I think one of the dream ways that I think of like a CSA, it's like, oh, are there inroads for us to build like a network of people that we can potentially organize towards other political goals and actions and effects?
CSAs and the food they provide can be sources of community power. Being in New York City can make me feel cut off from the producers who sustain us, but joining a CSA can help you reconnect with where your food comes from. You'll have access to the freshest produce and even more nourishing community.
So Matt, my research is on the history of American foodways. And something that I love is when you study the history of foodways, you see this consistent story of Americans exploring creative ways to distribute nutritious and affordable food when the government or the mainstream food manufacturing industry fails to feed the people. And there's different moments of this through history. During the 1930s, when there was the Great Depression, during the 1960s, there was an explosion of food cooperatives. And sometimes scholars call this the counter cuisine, the kind of gastronomic outpost of the counterculture. And I would argue we're in one of those moments today where new experiments are arising and we're returning to old models to feed people in a more affordable and accessible way. And I really want to emphasize that Black Americans in particular have been at the forefront of this movement. The supermarket is clearly an easy way to shop. I go to the supermarket all the time. Sometimes I even love cruising around in my cart. But it was invented to make consumption easier, and it depends on a highly industrialized food system that oftentimes hurts both farmers and eaters. So this is your sign to explore an alternative way to get your groceries, to check out your local food co-op or sign up for a CSA. You know, when I move to a new neighborhood or new city, part of, you know, you get your library card, you find your CSA, you find your co-op, and it's a great way to be participating in the community and supporting local foodways.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much, Liv, for doing this episode with us. I learned a lot.
Thanks for having me, Matt. And we'll include more resources in the show notes for further reading about the counter cuisine, about the role of supermarkets during the Cold War, and about the Black Panthers service program. So for those of you who can't get enough history, check out our show notes.
Extra special thanks this week to our guest co-host, Liv Cummins-Berkowitz. And thank you to our story producers, Sasha DuBose, Charlotte Rhodes, and Elias Guerra. Meat and Three is produced by H. Connolly, Taylor Early, and me, Matt Patterson. Our theme song was composed by Breakmaster Cylinder. This program is supported in part by public funds from the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs in partnership with the City Council. Meat and Three is powered by Simplecast. Meat and Three is a production of Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org and follow us at heritage_radio. And please stay in touch. Whether you have a story idea or would just like to say hey, write us at ideas@meatandthree.nyc. That's all spelled out.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.